Hello, my name is Jordan Shapiro. I'm a fellow in gastroenterology and hepatology at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And this is a podcast on the physiology of swallowing. And this is what we hope is the first in a series of podcasts that address and get back to some of the roots of the anatomy and physiology of the organ systems that we deal with on an everyday basis. And this was really spurred by an ongoing passion for this by Dr. David Graham, and will be contributed to by a number of faculty members. For each of the podcasts, we will provide a few reading resources or suggested readings, and then we will try to synthesize a number of pieces of information, not wanting to get so detailed that it's not very appealing to listen to in a podcast, but also wanting to dive a little bit deeper into things that are perhaps relevant to clinical practice. So without further ado, I'm going to start on the first of these podcasts, which is the physiology of swallowing. So the first question to pose, to think about, what are the three phases of swallowing? And so don't be bashful if you've forgotten these or don't remember them. There are three. The first is oral. So food goes in the mouth, and there are two parts of the oral phase of swallowing. One is the preparatory phase, which we'll talk a little bit more about, chewing. And then the second part of the oral phase is propulsive. So chew it up, grind it up, and push it back before we send it on its way to the second phase, which is the pharyngeal phase. And then the third phase is the esophageal phase. So I'm going to pause here for a moment and spend a separate segment, or record each segment separately, going through the oral phase, then the pharyngeal phase, and then the esophageal phase of swallowing. So we'll begin with the oral phase of swallowing. And there are, again, two components to this: the preparatory phase, which happens in the oral cavity, and then sort of transitions towards the oral pharynx at the end of the oral phase. The anatomy of the oral cavity begins at the oral vestibule, which is between the teeth and the lips, and it ends at the palatal glossal arch. If you have a person sitting next to you, they may see you listening with your earbuds and have no idea what you're listening to. And if you just ask them to open their mouth so you can look inside without specifying why, it might be humorous. But if you look in the back of your throat or someone sitting next to you, you'll see two arches. The more anterior one is the palatal glossal arch. That is the end of the oral cavity anatomically. Posterior to that, further back, is the palatal pharyngeal arch. And that is an important landmark because that's actually the beginning of the oral pharynx. Oral pharynx being the first portion of the pharynx, which has three different parts. The anatomical distinction is important because once you get back to the oral pharynx, palatal pharyngeal arch, there is a very large number, there's a very large number of afferent nerve fibers that we'll talk more about later, but that is has anatomical and functional distinctions when you get to the palatal pharyngeal arch. And of course, between the two arches is the tonsillar fossa. So why is chewing recommended prior to swallowing? Well, you may think that it's not necessary, or we may under-chew, but it does three important things. It reduces the size of the particles to help passage and prevent injury. It increases the surface area for digestion to begin in the mouth. We'll talk in a little bit more about that in a moment, but also further down in the GI tract. And then it mixes food with saliva to begin digestion and to lubricate it. It begins digestion because in the saliva, there is both lingual lipase and salivary amylase. Chewing is mediated by voluntary and involuntary reflexes. So when you put food in the mouth, it initially inhibits muscles of mastication. This stretch then causes activation of those muscles to chomp down. When you chomp down, there are a number of factors, the shortening of those muscles, as well as the compression on mucosal surfaces, which then inhibits them and allows the mouth to open again. And when this goes on and on and on, back and forth with activation and inhibition of masticatory muscles, you get the rhythmic chewing, of course, with some central mediation as well. If you want to know a little bit more detail just about the opening and closing of the mouth, in general, if you remember one thing, that the trigeminal nerve or cranial nerve 5, the third division, which is the mandibular division, there's an ophthalmic V1 and maxillary V2, but the third portion of the trigeminal nerve carries out most of the motor functions of chewing. The greatest determinant, or one of the greatest determinants of swallowing rate, is actually lubrication of food. So we talked a little bit about the importance of saliva. And so if you think about this, obviously there are other things that contribute to how quickly you can swallow a food bolus. Certainly if it's completely liquid, that's going to be different than a solid food bolus. But for a given size, lubrication is one of the most important things to help it pass quickly. A brief note on taste, since we're hanging out in that part of the mouth for just a brief moment more. The anterior two-thirds of the tongue taste is mediated by the facial nerve, cranial nerve 7, and the posterior third is by the glossopharyngeal nerve, or cranial nerve 9. And that one's going to come back quite a bit as we get into the pharyngeal phase of swallowing. Once you've prepared the food, so we've chomped it up and lubricated it and started digestion with the salivary amylase and lingual lipase, we got to prepare it to send it further back. We can't just let it kind of drip back into the to the pharynx and hope it goes down the right place. There's a sequence of events that happens very unconsciously most of the time. And that is the dance of the tongue. And so the tongue's muscles, both the extrinsic muscles that help elevate the tongue and the intrinsic ones that help you make interesting shapes with it, are really critical in this next phase. And so if you hold your hand out in front of you, you have the four fingers sticking out, and those sort of form a ramp down into the palm of your hand. And that's really, you can think about that as what the tongue is doing on the palate. So in this phase of swallowing, the tongue is going to separate a small portion of the bolus in the mouth. It's going to put it back in the what is the equivalent of the palm of the hand, so the dorsum or the posterior part of the tongue. It's going to form a little depression there to hold it, and then it's going to press up the superior ridge of the tongue against the palate to form a nice seal. All of those movements of the tongue are mediated by the hypoglossal nerve, which is cranial nerve 12. This allows a few things to happen, but it really sets that food up and creates almost a ramp for that bolus of food in the dorsum of the tongue to go directly into the oropharynx. So it hits the palatopharyngeal arch. It's now in the pharynx, and this moves us into the pharyngeal phase of swallowing. And so with that, we're going to take a quick break, and I will pick up in the pharyngeal phase. Well, as promised, We're following that little bolus of food that dropped off the back of the tongue into the oropharynx, which began with the palatopharyngeal arch. And this is a very highly innervated area, largely by fibers that are afferent sensory fibers of the glossopharyngeal nerve or cranial nerve 9. These afferents go to nucleus ambiguous in the brainstem, the swallowing center, which is in the medulla and part in the pons, perhaps, and then ends up activating the vagus nerve, which does some of the motor functions. So the glossopharyngeal nerve, cranial nerve 9, is really critical in a lot of the sensory things in the back of the throat for swallowing, for gag reflex testing. And so there is an important thing to ask is we're pushing this bolus or dumping this bolus back into the oropharynx, trying to send it down the esophagus as to, well, what keeps it from going in other holes we don't want it to go in? So why doesn't it go into the nasopharynx? Well, it turns out that when the glossopharyngeal nerve is activated, it activates the vagus nerve to lift the soft palate. There are a couple of key muscles involved in this that are vaguely innervated, but those may not be as important as just to remember that the stimulation of the back of the oropharynx, glossopharyngeal nerve, triggers the vagus nerve to then lift the soft palate. Those muscles, for the nerds out there, are the levator veli palatini, which does the heavy lifting, and then the tensor veli palatini, which really tenses the soft palate and allows the levator veli palatini to do the heavy lifting. So that's why it doesn't go into the nasopharynx. Why doesn't it go into the trachea? And this is a bit more common. So as the bolus goes through the pharynx and begins to move by peristaltic contraction, starting with the superior constrictor and then the middle and inferior pharyngeal constrictor muscles, there's a simultaneous relaxation of the upper esophageal sphincter. And we're going to talk more about that in a moment, but that is partly contributed by the lifting upward and anteriorly of the pharynx and larynx, as previously mentioned. And also, and this seems to put some traction on the upper esophageal sphincter, but there's also some neurogenic inhibition of the contraction of that muscle, which is at baseline contracted. The oral and pharyngeal parts that we just spent more than a second talking about take about a second in real life. They're very quick. And it's important to note that one of the key portions to really trigger most of the swallow we think of as a swallow is that sensory component in the back of the palatopharyngeal area in the posterior oropharynx that you can try to initiate a swallow voluntarily, but it's almost necessary in order to have a small bit of saliva or food bolus hit that and trigger the rest of the reflexive portion of the swallow. A couple of nerve things related to swallowing that, and then a little bit more detail about the upper esophageal sphincter, and that will wrap up this pharyngeal phase of swallowing. So the upper esophageal sphincter is the end of the pharyngeal phase. Once you pass through there and the tail of the bolus, if you think about it like a comet, the tail of the bolus goes through the upper esophageal sphincter and you are now into the esophageal phase of swallowing. So the swallowing center, as mentioned before, which it helps with some cortical input as well, but swallowing center is in the brainstem and really coordinates the afferent and efferent components and contributors to swallowing. So the afferents from the pharynx get directed to the swallowing center, and this coordinates some of the efferent outputs from different cranial nerve nuclei, as well as the nucleus ambiguous, The efferents from the center get distributed to the pharynx via nerves from the nucleus ambiguus in a sequential manner, proximally to distally. So, as I mentioned, the upper esophageal sphincter is the end of the pharyngeal phase of swallowing. It's about 2 to 4 centimeters long. It exists the UES, which is helpful, I think, to know anatomically from an endoscopy and imaging standpoint. It's about a centimeter below the vocal cords and is at about C5, C6, so the cervical vertebrae 5 and 6. That's about the level that the upper esophageal sphincter is at. The upper esophageal sphincter is really synonymous in many ways with the cricopharyngeous muscle. And so the cricopharyngeous muscle is this ring of muscle that attaches to the back sides of the cricoid cartilage. So that's another way to kind of anatomically have a sense as to where that is. And it contracts to close the lumen against the cricoid. This muscle is relaxed under anesthesia and sleep. So that's why, even though it's not been shown to be as effective as it was once thought, people often apply some cricoid pressure. They're really trying to do the work of the upper esophageal sphincter, which is relaxed under an anesthetic. The upper portion of the upper esophageal sphincter is the lower part of the inferior pharyngeal constrictor. The cricopharyngeus is a slow twitch muscle. It has some sustained activity or tonic activity. It's very elastic and it's striated. So it receives motor inputs from the nucleus ambiguus and is activated basically using acetylcholine. The motor components of it are pharyngeal branches from the vagus nerve and the recurrent laryngeal nerve, and then there are sensory inputs from the nucleus tractus solitarius. But I think the most important thing is probably the anatomy of this in a way. And the function of the upper esophageal sphincter is that you don't want air entering the esophagus and you don't want food going into the airway. And so in deep inspiration, for instance, the upper esophageal sphincter pressure increases. And as I mentioned before, there are some things like sleep and anesthesia that decrease it. The tone and pressure is also increased with stress, agitation, with speech, and you can actually trigger an increase in contraction of the upper esophageal sphincter just with a puff of air, which is why we probably sometimes see a little bit of that when we're inserting an endoscope and if on the air, that can actually potentially cause a contraction just briefly of the upper esophageal sphincter. With swallowing, the upper esophageal sphincter moves about 2.5 centimeters superiorly. And as it is pulled superiorly, one of the ways that it relaxes as the superior, middle, and inferior pharyngeal constrictor muscles peristalse the bolus towards the esophagus is that this movement of the UES, or upper esophageal sphincter, actually puts some traction on it. And that's one of two ways that it's thought to relax or disrupt its normal state, which is contracting and closing the lumen. Then there's also a second manner in which it relaxes, which is more direct inhibition of nerves that innervate it. And then another thing that increases the upper esophageal sphincter pressure, which makes sense, is with gastroesophageal reflux disease. So when you have reflux, it's a protective mechanism for the upper esophageal sphincter pressure to increase. And it actually increases more than the esophageal pressure, which is increasing to try to clear the reflux. So that ends the pharyngeal phase of swallowing. Nuance and a bit more going on. Fortunately, once we get into the esophagus, it's a bit more straightforward, and so we'll wrap up with that, and that will end this first podcast on GI physiology. So wrapping up with the esophageal phase of swallowing, to begin the esophageal anatomy, just the basics, the body of the esophagus is about 20 centimeters in length. And so what that means is that when we typically think that at around 40 centimeters of scope in a patient that we're at the GE junction, that means about the first half is actually our anatomical structures above the esophageal body. And then we pop through the upper esophageal sphincter and we're into about 20 centimeters of esophagus. So it starts at about 18 to 20 centimeters at the bottom of the upper esophageal sphincter and usually ends around 40 centimeters, although that's quite variable, range from 26 to 50 centimeters for the end of the esophagus, and that's from the incisors, and then it's slightly shorter in women, usually around 37 centimeters, again with quite a bit of variation. And then the last 2 to 4 centimeters are really the lower esophageal sphincter region, which is not an anatomically identifiable structure, but is probably most clearly seen on the manometry tracings that we get. The esophagus, as you probably remember, is striated muscle in the upper third, smooth muscle in the distal third, and then the middle is a sort of a gradual change from more striated to more smooth muscle, but is a mix of both types of muscle. The anatomy of the esophagus as far as its course is also helpful to know. So there are three segments, the cervical, thoracic, and abdominal esophageal portions. And the esophagus is in the posterior mediastinum. It is behind the trachea and the left main stem bronchus. And it curves slightly to the left, behind the heart, and then in front of the aorta. And it goes through the esophageal hiatus in the diaphragm, just anterior to the opening for the descending aorta to pass through. You can imagine a number of different scenarios in which the anatomical course of the esophagus is important to know. And one rare but important one to be aware of is the risk for atrial esophageal fistulae with radiofrequency ablation in the setting of atrial fibrillation. That one of the biggest and most terrifying complications of RFA is actually injury to the esophagus that can range from a simple ulcer to a fistula from the aorta or atria to the esophagus, and that's almost universally fatal. So maybe helpful to pause here and pull up cross-sectional imaging of the esophagus as it courses through from the UES to the stomach. Peristalsis and the movement of the esophagus is primarily driven by the vagus nerve, a cranial nerve 10. You can think of the esophagus as a flaccid tube that at rest, the body is relaxed, and there are these tight sphincters on both ends of it in order to prevent air from going into the esophagus, in order to prevent reflux from entering the esophagus in the case of the lower esophageal sphincter, and for reflux that does get into the esophagus, since some degree of reflux is normal, the UES protects the body from having that reflux enter the pharynx and the larynx. Peristalsis in the esophagus is slower than the oral and pharyngeal phases of propelling a bolus towards the esophagus. And so we mentioned that the oropharyngeal portion of swallowing is usually over in about 1 second. Esophageal peristalsis typically takes about 2 to 6 centimeters per second, or the moves about 2 to 6 centimeters per second. And so it can take 10 to 15 seconds for a bolus to pass completely into the stomach. It's important to note that what is swallowed as far as consistency does matter when it comes to peristalsis. So when you swallow just pure liquids, if everything is working normally, the liquids often hit the stomach before the peristaltic wave is completed. Whereas, more traditionally thought about bolus of solid food is pushed down by peristalsis. This is a good time to bring up the different types of peristalsis. So the two important ones to know about are primary peristalsis and secondary peristalsis. Primary peristalsis is a continuation of the peristaltic wave that is begun in the pharyngeal phase with the pharyngeal constrictor muscles. So we talked about the triggering of the contraction of the superior, then middle and inferior pharyngeal constrictors. And that continues that peristaltic wave into the esophageal body. So primary peristalsis is kind of a normal swallow, peristalsis all the way from the pharyngeal phase through the esophageal body. Secondary peristalsis, which is a normal phenomenon, you can think of as a mechanism the esophagus intrinsically has to clear anything that doesn't pass or that shouldn't be there after primary peristalsis or in between swallows. So that may be you took a spoonful of peanut butter and the initial peristaltic wave got part of it down but didn't go all the way. The distension in the esophagus is the primary trigger for secondary peristalsis, and you may have several secondary peristaltic waves to completely clear the esophagus. This is also an important mechanism for clearing the esophagus of reflux or other noxious stimuli, and that can also trigger secondary peristaltic waves. The difference being that those do not have their origin as a continuation, really, of a primary peristaltic wave from the pharyngeal constrictors. There's a contribution to the passage of food through the esophageal body from gravity, but as you may very well know, even standing on your head, you can, with peristalsis, get the food to move from sort of the orad or the head side of things, top side, to the stomach. So they still peristalse in the correct direction. But gravity is an important mechanism, and in some animals, such as certain birds, a pelican, they actually have very little esophageal motility and peristalsis, and so that is part of the reason why they tip their head back and basically just let gravity do the work to slide fish down. So we're lucky in that we've got a little extra kick in the esophageal motility realm of things compared to a pelican. I want to talk briefly about what happens with esophageal obstruction. And so if you have a fixed obstruction, this was initially studied using inflated balloons in the esophagus during manometry and barium studies, there's a powerful sustained propulsive force. So there's a big squeeze and it's sustained. And the bigger the bolus, the bigger the and more powerful that sustained propulsive force is. This is also stronger in the lower esophagus, and it may be because smooth muscle has this intrinsic quality that if you stretch it, it contracts. Everything distal to the obstruction in the esophagus is typically relaxed. And then if the obstruction begins to move, that sustained propulsive force then converts to a peristaltic wave. And so again, this was done in the initial studies using a tethered or fixed balloon that couldn't move, and then deflating the balloon and following that initial propulsive, sustained propulsive force that transitioned into a peristaltic wave. The lower esophageal sphincter is an anatomic region that is contributed to by the diaphragmatic crura, phrenoesophageal ligament, from the diaphragm that attaches near the region of the lower esophageal sphincter. And the control of the lower esophageal sphincter, which is at baseline contracted and has a resting pressure of about 20 to 40 millimeters of mercury, is contributed to by what is thought to be largely myogenic constriction at baseline, but there are also other inputs that we know about. So acetylcholine can cause it to contract to be more tonically contracted. Gastrin can increase that. It is decreased by prostaglandins, calcium channel blockers, nitric oxide, vasointestinal peptide. So if you remember that at rest, likely the LES is largely driven by inherent myogenic tone, and that excitatory neurotransmitter would be acetylcholine, and then inhibitory ones would be nitric oxide, vasointestinal peptide. But there are some other things like calcium channel blockers that working through ultimately nitric oxide pathways can also inhibit the LES. So the LES is also under neural control. So as the vagus nerve is mediating this peristaltic wave down the esophageal body, the LES actually relaxes about 2 seconds after the initiation of a swallow. So while the food is still actually at the beginning of the esophageal phase of swallowing, the LES has already relaxed. And then similar to the continuation of the pharyngeal peristaltic wave in the pharyngeal constrictor muscle group, and the continuation of that into a primary peristaltic wave in the esophagus, so too is there continuation into the ORAD portion of the stomach. So the body and fundus do what is called receptive relaxation, and this area relaxes to accept food. It can accept up to 1600 cc's of air without more than about a 10 millimeter of mercury rise in pressure, so this ability to change the compliance of the stomach or accommodation is very important. That can be lost after vagotomy. And so this receptive relaxation, though, is what is called a vagovagal reflex, meaning that the afferents and efferents of this reflex are all contained within the vagus nerve. The last thing I'll touch on briefly are transient lower esophageal sphincter relaxations. The lower esophageal sphincter is meant to prevent reflux into the esophagus, but it also needs to open to vent the stomach. And so the biggest trigger for transient lower esophageal sphincter relaxations is distension. And these are meant to allow for the patient to belch, vomit, retch, just vent air from the stomach that's swallowed with each swallow. Difference physiologically between belching and vomiting and rumination, for instance, is that belching and vomiting, there is no esophageal contraction. It's just relaxation and then gastric contraction. Rumination actually is accompanied by a reverse in peristalsis that you can see on manometry. I believe that will wrap up this section on esophageal phase of swallowing, and look forward to your comments and feedback, and look forward to the next section of GI physiology. Thank you for listening, and please tune in to the next podcast.